Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Dr. Kiki's Science Hour is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Dr. Kiki's Science Hour with me, Dr. Kiki Sanford, episode 121, recorded Thursday, November 17th, 2011, Detours in the Brain. This episode of Dr. Kiki's Science Hour is brought to you by Ford, featuring available sync with My Ford Touch. Sync with My Ford Touch gets you to your destination with integrated turn-by-turn directions and directional arrows displayed on screen. Check it out in the new 2012 Ford Focus and at ford.com/technology. And by Netflix. Watch thousands of TV episodes and movies on your PC, Mac, iPad, iPhone, or TV instantly. All streamed directly to you, saving you time, money, and hassle. For your free 30-day trial, go to netflix.com/twit. Welcome, everyone, to Dr. Kiki's Science Hour. I'm Dr. Kiki Sanford, and this is the show where you get to dig into one topic in the sciences for an entire hour with one expert. And I hope you're ready to dig into today's subject, because we're going to be talking about the brain. My favorite subject, right? Specifically today, we're going to be discussing the subject of what happens when there's no connection, or maybe less of a connection than there should be, between the two halves of your brain. It's called agenesis of the corpus callosum. And today we're going to be talking with Dr. Lynn Paul from Caltech about what we know about this rare brain disorder. But first, you know you love them, the science headlines. Let's get started. According to a paper in Nature, it appears likely that Jupiter's moon Europa has a giant lake of liquid water lying just 1.8 miles below the icy surface. The existence of such a lake would increase the probability of life on the Jovian moon. NASA's new budget has been approved to the tune of $5.1 billion. Line items in the budget maintain the scheduled deployment of the James Webb Space Telescope in 2018. Woohoo! But unfortunately, reduced the funding allotted to transporting crews to and from the International Space Station. Scientists say they have finally turned hydrogen gas into a metal, which should happen because it's a metal halide. So to do so, the gas was placed in an alumina epoxy gasket and placed that within a diamond anvil cell. They turned up the pressure to 220 gigapascals. It became opaque and conductive. Then they recorded a 20% increase in electrical resistance. Voila, metal. Gerin Corporation announced it will stop its planned embryonic stem cell trials due to economic reasons. This was the first FDA-approved trial of embryonic stem cell technologies. Researchers reported that cardiac stem cells taken from patients during heart bypass surgery were safely injected back into the hearts of the patients themselves. The procedural trial was only meant to prove safety, but the report in The Lancet also described improvements in cardiac function in all 7 patients who received the stem cell therapy. The color of your snot might indeed be a marker for what kind of infection you're fighting. A study published in the European Respiratory Journal found that yellow or green mucus, or sputum, is more likely to be the result of a bacterial infection, while clear sputum is more indicative of other causes. Gamers' brains are different. According to a study in the journal Translational Psychiatry, regular gamers have a larger ventral striatum than people who game infrequently or not at all. This area of the brain is central to the reward system, addiction's home, but it can't be determined if the ventral striatum is larger as a result of gaming or was larger to begin with in these individuals. Finally, a preliminary study published in The Lancet suggests that some people in a vegetative state might actually be more aware of their surroundings than previously thought. Using an electroencephalography, researchers showed that 3 of 16 people were able to activate the same areas of the brain as healthy individuals when given a particular command. Interestingly, 3 of the healthy volunteers weren't able to activate those brain areas either. And with that, we'll move on to the rest of the show. This episode of Dr. Kiki Science Hour is brought to you by Ford, featuring Sync with My Ford Touch. Sync is the in-car communications, entertainment, and connectivity system that's voice-activated to help you keep your hands on the wheel and your eyes on the road. One of the great features of Sync is Sync Services. Sync Services gives you audible turn-by-turn directions to where you want to go and displays directional arrows on screen, all without having to purchase an aftermarket or integrated navigation system, which is pretty good for those who are watching their wallets. Sync Services also includes business search of over 40 million businesses, including telephone numbers, business information, and directions on how to get there. A Send to Sync feature, which enables you to use Google Maps or MapQuest from your home or office computer to plan a trip, save it online to your Sync traffic directions and information systems account, then use voice commands in your vehicle to get turn-by-turn directions. A free Sync destination app is available in the app stores, which gives you mobile access to manage your Sync traffic directions and information systems account on the go. The ability to pre-save destinations to your account, such as home or office. Plus, you can get traffic updates sent to your mobile account via text messages. It's all designed to help you keep your hands on your wheel and your eyes on the road. Ford Sync with My Ford Touch is available in the 2012 Ford Focus. You can learn more about this and other technologies Ford is bringing to its vehicles at ford.com/technology. So without any further ado, it's time to bring in the guest expert. And there's this wonderful video available online, a public media station program focused on the research that we're going to be discussing today. So I thought I would start out the conversation and introduction with a peek at this video.
So tell me, Tony, when did you get this diagnosis?
Back in 2001.
Do you feel like you're missing part of your brain?
Not really, but I know I am.
How do you think it affects you? What are the things that you have a hard time with?
Well, I'm not that much of a social person for one, so.
Okay. Tony is a 20-year-old man who has AGCC, a condition where you're born without the corpus callosum. And the corpus callosum is the band of fibers that connect the two hemispheres. 200 million fibers. It's the largest single structure in the brain. So its absence is pretty obvious. What was school like for you?
Technically, math was the hardest for me. I think it still is.
Okay. Are movies confusing?
Plot-wise for me, yes.
Part of why I do this, personally, is I was an awkward kid. Different reasons. But boy, do I know the feeling of, why do they all get along and they all hate me? If I can help somebody else understand themselves so that they don't have to experience that, of course that's what I want to do. The work on AGCC began essentially with Roger Sperry's work on the split brain.
One puzzling aspect of the study is the fact that all our activities are controlled not by one brain, but by two interconnected half-brains.
Roger Sperry here at Caltech did a lot of experiments where you can show that each hemisphere processes information separately.
Working with him on a series of unique experiments is Dr. Michael Gazzaniga.
The brain is, of course, an enormously complex structure. In fact, it's kind of redundantly complex. We have two cerebral hemispheres.
And in the brain is organized in two hemispheres, two halves, separated down the middle. And for most of us, there's a pretty classic organization of what parts of the brain handle what types of functions.
The left hemisphere takes on functions of sequential analysis, spatial analysis, language. The right hemisphere is really the seat of more emotional aspects, happiness and sadness and disgust.
Dr. Lynn Paul has been a visiting associate at Caltech University since 2004. Her primary research focus is the role of the corpus callosum in emotions and social cognition. Dr. Paul heads the Caltech Corpus Callosum Research Program and an interinstitutional research consortium on AGCC. Dr. Paul is also the founding president of the National Organization of Disorders of the Corpus Callosum, a nonprofit corporation that gathers and disseminates information on these conditions to individuals with corpus callosum disorders, their families, and professionals. Welcome to the show. Thank you so much for joining me, Dr. Paul.
My pleasure.
It's wonderful to have you here and be able to talk about this topic. It's something that I don't know that many people would even know that there is a problem, that there can be a problem dealing with the communication between the two halves of their brain. You think of your brain normally as your brain. Single entity, one thing, lump of material inside of your head. Can you give us a little bit of the basics on, you know, how the two different halves of the brain communicate?
The primary structure that helps the brain communicate, the hemispheres communicate, is the corpus callosum, and it consists of about 190 million to 200 million nerve fibers that transmit information along axons from one hemisphere to the other. And typically, it's from one area of the brain to the homologous area of the other hemisphere. So it's matching sides and allowing those two parts of the brain, one representing the right and one representing the left, to coordinate their activity. There are a few other smaller commissures. The anterior commissure has about 50 million fibers. There's also the hippocampal commissure, the anterior commissure, both of which are very small. And then there are routes through the lower portions of the brain that also facilitate some communication. But the primary route for the higher levels of communication, we've always believed since Roger Sperry's work, was the corpus callosum.
So when you're talking about the higher functions, that's probably the higher cognitive functions.
Right.
Yeah. Okay, so if the corpus callosum doesn't form correctly, or if it doesn't form at all and can't work, what happens?
Well, it forms. Let's back up a second. It forms in utero at about the 12th to 16th week of gestation. You can see it on scans by 18 weeks. And if those fibers don't cross the gap between the two hemispheres at that point, they won't. So there's kind of a pivotal window there where you've got to get that first one to go across, and then the others all follow. So often people ask, can you develop one? No, if you didn't get it then, it's not going to happen. If it's absent, your brain accommodates it surprisingly well.
Right.
So someone with this condition, like you saw in the video, Tony, he's a young adult man. He's in his 20s. And for him, without a lot of other brain malformations, cognition's pretty intact. He had some learning delays in school. And then probably the easiest way to say it is, if you think about something like language, some cognitive task, when you first learn it, your whole brain is really involved in that process. You're pulling all of your resources to this new thing because it's new.
Right.
Whereas if you look at our brains when we're learning, using language, if I'm speaking and you look at what parts of my brain are most active, it's really localized because it's simplified. So whatever is new is going to require more corpus callosum involvement. And in adult life, the things that we come across that are new constantly are social interactions, problem solving, those kind of complicated things that you have to do rapidly and are always a bit different. And so those are the kind of things we're finding are impaired in this condition in adulthood.
Okay. So, but you're talking in development, are there massive problems with learning? Like you're talking about the learning of language. If the whole brain is supposed to be learning language, is development of language impaired? So slowed down?
Yeah. For a lot of the individuals with this condition, yes. So whatever is new at a given point is likely to be challenging. Some of the individuals with this condition really meet their developmental milestones without too much difficulty, but a lot of them start to show difficulty in elementary school, usually by third or fourth grade. So reading is a problem, and then they may master it.
Is there a difference? So when you see these developmental problems in a child, and you know that there's language development or social development is stunted, you're going to observe that as the child gets older. And how does this corpus callosum or any corpus callosum disorder compare to other brain disorders that we're familiar with, like autism or schizophrenia? Schizophrenia, I know, is a more adult disorder, but does it present similarly?
This is a great question. And I love the way you said it, because you said other brain disorders, but those schizophrenia and autism are both diagnosed by behavior, not by neuroanatomy.
Right.
So a fundamental difference is we're talking about a condition that is defined by anatomy. And then we as researchers have been working to understand the behavioral syndrome that is a consequence of that. At the same time, you've got the people studying the psychiatric conditions that are trying to figure out what the neurological underpinnings are of those conditions.
Right.
So to get back to your original question, the kids with agenesis often will get diagnosed with something like attention deficit disorder. About 30% of our subjects or our participants in our research have met criteria for an autism spectrum diagnosis. They may get labeled with various things, and it's always kind of a, you know, they're not quite like the others with this condition, but it fits kind of feeling.
Right. So often there's like they kind of fit into this situation, but they're not, it's not quite right. So maybe we should is that the point at which somebody says we should maybe do some more testing and go in for MRIs to actually see what the structure, if the structure of the brain is different?
There tend to be three times that it is diagnosed. It can be diagnosed in utero by ultrasound, or if a child has a lot of other physical anomalies at birth, it might be diagnosed then. The second is what you indicated, where you have a child who's in elementary school and having a lot of problems. You might have a teacher that thinks they see the child having a seizure or spacing out. You might have just a really squeaky wheel kind of parent who throws a little bit that someone finally does a scan. And then the third reason is typically an adult who were always a bit odd anyway, but ended up having an MRI for some completely unrelated reason.
Right. And in the video we saw, you asked the patient whether he felt like he was missing a part of his brain, and he said, "No, I don't feel like I'm missing anything. I know I'm different from other people." Do people just often go through their lives? Do you find that they go through their life and they're like, "Yeah, I'm just a little different. That's all."
Yeah, one of the things that is so striking is for the adults that get the diagnosis, it can be a relief because it explains the difficulties that they've had.
Right. In terms of diagnosis rate, not just kids or adults, but what is the prevalence within the population? Like how often is it diagnosed?
I don't know prevalence rates. I do know that incidence studies in California in the last decade found about one out of every 4,000 live births involved a corpus callosum disorder.
Okay, and for
it's
for
probably
reference,
more than that.
Yeah, it might be more than that. I know for reference, people are more familiar with autism, and autism is about one in every 1,000, possibly more than that, but conservatively one in every 1,000. So it's a bit more than autism, but still within the same order of magnitude.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Is this something that does, in terms of underlying causes, does it seem to be a genetic malady, or is this something that you can tie it back to certain environmental contaminants during gestation, or what is there any tie to anything so far?
Yes, to both.
Okay.
There's a higher incidence of corpus callosum malformations in fetal alcohol syndrome. But of course, not every child with fetal alcohol syndrome has a corpus callosum disorder. So
Right. That
does let us know that some kind of environmental toxin or event during gestation can impact this. There are also several genetic conditions and chromosomal syndromes that have a higher than typical incidence of corpus callosum disorders. There, I believe, are only like one maybe that always involves a corpus callosum disorder. Mm-hmm. So at this point, it appears to be a pretty complex genetic pattern, not a single Mendelian kind of genetic heritability.
Right. Well, for something that's such an integral part of what we think of as such an integral part of the information highway within the brain, you'd think there would be a lot of genes involved. And so any number of genes could possibly go wrong.
Yeah. At the same time, the critical thing is this really happens at a specific point in development. So
right,
if those... And we now know more from mouse models. There's some great work going on in Australia looking at mouse models and the neural development of the corpus callosum. And in understanding the neural development of the callosum, we can begin to hypothesize about where it becomes impaired or that process gets impeded in humans.
Right, because we know that during certain phases of development, certain genes get turned on, certain things are turned off, and so maybe you can pinpoint the instructions that are
exactly
that are happening. Right, that's really interesting. I like it. It's neat that you, through these different methods, you're slowly going to be able to get a path to what might be causing this to happen. It's really neat.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. How did you personally get involved in studying corpus callosum disorders? And you've founded the National Organization of Disorders on the Corpus Callosum, so you're obviously very passionate about this. How did this come about?
It was the end of my first year of grad school, and I didn't have any research project for my doctoral work, and someone happened to be reading an abstract by Dr. Warren Brown and said, hey, he's looking for somebody to work on this project. And that began it all. And
I know how that goes. Yeah. I've been there.
Science has a lot of fortuitousness in it.
Yeah.
He had been working with this group and looking at interhemispheric transfer. He had tested some of Sperry's patients. This was really fascinating. He had these two adolescents, and he had tested both of them on all of these kind of behavioral paradigms. And at some point, he thought, I'm going to get their families together and just sit back and listen. And so he brought the parents in and he took notes. And out of that, he realized the big story, their big problem was in social skills, empathy, insight, problem solving. So the point that I joined with Warren on these projects was as he was trying to figure out how do I assess empathy and insight and executive functioning. So that was almost 20 years ago.
That's great. And so in the last 20 years, what kind of strides have you seen taken in this area? Has it been massive, or are you still like, well, I wish we had learned more by now?
Yes.
To both.
Okay. I mean, when I say he had two participants, 20 years ago, to have two young adults with normal IQ and agenesis of the corpus callosum was a fascinating, exciting study.
Yeah.
By the time I finished my doctoral work in the later 90s, I think we were up to maybe 10. Now, we have studies going on, publishing behavioral studies with over 40 participants, and many more than that that we've tested over the years. So part of it is the awareness of the condition has increased. Mm-hmm. Our connections with families has improved, and that's given us a lot clearer picture. So that's one substantial development, is just having a population to work with.
Yeah.
The other thing is Warren and I really have focused on trying to understand the cognitive syndrome that comes from this condition. And when we started working on this, the lore in neurology was you could be perfectly normal without a corpus callosum. And we still hear that from time to time. I always say I've yet to meet anyone who is missing their corpus callosum that I would say is perfectly normal. Some are higher functioning than others. But there is clearly a consequence for missing this huge part of your brain. And so to be able to identify that and help answer this question, the question that usually is presented by parents is, what if this behavior that I'm seeing is my kid, and what if it is this condition?
Right. That's a really good question, too.
Right. And basically they're asking, what is volitional that I should be parenting in a, particular way, and what if this really represents some kind of deficit that I need to be helping them accommodate or compensate for? So by putting together this syndrome and being able to define it, we can give parents a better idea of how to proceed.
Yeah. In studying it, are you finding that complete agenesis of the corpus callosum is a particular category of the syndrome versus just partial agenesis? So for people listening, whether or not it's partially formed or not formed at all, does that make a difference in the behaviors that you see?
We haven't found that yet, or at this point, that there's, at least at the level of the kind of cognitive things that we're looking at. If you look at some of the more motor behaviors, you would probably see some differences. But there's one thing I want to say here. It isn't like having some callosum is better than having none.
Mm-hmm.
And recent work from UCSF, our collaborators there, they've done diffusion tractography looking at how the people that have part of the corpus callosum, how that wiring is distributed, how those neurons are connecting. And the presumption has been that if you have this portion, it's the same as having that portion in an intact
fully
corpus
formed
callosum.
Yeah.
And then the rest of it's missing. And that's not the case. So if you have a part of the callosum, it's entirely possible that it is very different than having a typical homologous connections.
Right.
Which, if you think about that, that's a whole nother layer of complication.
Yeah, that can be very, if you have connections that are there but not in the right places, or if they're doing something that they wouldn't normally be doing, then that's going to cause trouble.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. So it's not, from what we can tell at this point, it's not a kind of a titrated effect that more is better and that type of thing.
All right. Well, I'm going to take this moment to talk about how more might be better in the case of Netflix, because they give you more options to watch at home, more TV shows and movies. This episode of Dr. Kiki Science Hour is brought to you by Netflix. Netflix streams thousands of TV episodes and movies directly to you instantly, which means you save time, money, and hassle. There are several easy ways to instantly access streaming movies and TV shows with Netflix. You can watch Netflix movies and shows on your Mac, PC, iPad, iPhone, some Android phones as well. If you have a gaming console like an Xbox, PS3, Nintendo Wii, you can watch it right on your television. Also, if you have a set-top box like a Roku or an Apple TV, these are pretty inexpensive and easy to use. With Netflix, you can watch movies and TV shows instantly using any of these devices, and you can begin watching a movie or show on one device, turn it off, and then finish on a completely different one. It remembers where you stopped. Whichever way you choose to access Netflix, you can watch as many movies and shows as you want, anytime you want, and cancel at any time. Try Netflix today for 30 days free. Go to netflix.com/twit. Be sure to use this URL when you sign up for your free trial, netflix.com/twit. We thank Netflix for their support of Twit, and we hope that you will enjoy watching instantly with Netflix. Back to the interview. I'm talking with Dr. Lynn Paul from Caltech about corpus callosum disorders and what happens when you don't have a corpus callosum or you only have part of it. We were talking before the brief break about how more having some callosum versus none might not necessarily be a good thing. In terms of people who are born with this disorder versus individuals who have corpus callosum severed for various reasons as an adult or later in life, what are we learning about the brain from looking at these two different populations?
We're learning a lot about how the brain develops and how it compensates. Essentially, the issue is plasticity. So if someone has the corpus callosum severed as an adult, as in Sperry's work, we learned a lot about lateralization of the brain, that we typically have parts of our functioning, our language functioning is more in the left hemisphere, spatial functioning more in the right. And it depends, we depend a lot on the communication through the corpus callosum to coordinate that. What is amazing is, as I said, these individuals can function remarkably well. So their brain has compensated for this absence. And that's the boundary that we're trying to push right now, is to figure out how they've compensated, how do they coordinate activity between their two hands or multiple appendages at once,
right,
any effective manner, and then what are the limits of that. But the other thing that is different is, because their brain never developed that lateralization in the first place, because mm-hmm. it didn't have callosum, it's not a direct comparison. So if you have a typically developed brain and you cut the callosum, it's going to have a significant impact that it doesn't have if you grew up without that callosum. Does that make
right.
sense?
Yeah. So during development, the brain compensates in a probably in some really interesting ways that we don't really understand how yet, but there's some yeah. compensation that happens.
There was a great study by a lab in Canada that did a lot of this work early on, that looked at a callosotomy in an adult and then in some children. And what they found was that when the corpus callosum was cut in children, they ended up a lot more like the kids with agenesis than they did like the adult with the callosotomy.
I wonder if they're for different different behavioral skills. I wonder if they're particular ages. You know, so we know that there's a period after which if you're not allowed to have visual input, there's a period after which the plastic period's over that you won't be able to see. Your brain just is going to just not be using that that real estate for vision anymore. We know that that there are these developmental windows that are very important. I wonder, you know, how that affects the corpus callosum.
Well, and that's a whole other kind of fascinating topic, because there is so much being learned currently, even about the plasticity of the visual system in adults. And while there are those critical windows, how absolute they are is being challenged.
Interesting. In terms of the research that you've been doing recently, the study that you recently published suggested that there is synchronous behavior between the two halves of the brain in people who have agenesis of the corpus callosum. What does this imply? And can you tell me a brief overview of the study?
Okay. In typical brains, intact brains, we've come to find there's a set of networks that are common amongst most of us, that when we're just resting and we're not thinking about anything in particular, our brain has coordinated activity in these networks, and they're pretty distributed across the brain. So it's not just an area, it's areas in both hemispheres, you know, anterior and posterior. It's 10 to 20 of these networks that seem to hold up across studies. Mm-hmm. So we wanted to see if we did that with our agenesis subjects, particularly those with complete agenesis, would you have a similar set of networks, with the presumption that in order to have these networks that are bilateral, in the two hemispheres mm-hmm. coordinated, that the corpus callosum has to be involved. And what we were surprised to find was that they have the same set of resting networks. They're bilateral to the same degree that ours are. So one thing that suggests is that you don't have to have the callosum to have those resting networks, that bilateral coordination. It doesn't answer the question of, do we, in a typical brain, use the callosum as part of the system that supports those resting networks? And because it's entirely possible that the individuals with complete agenesis have somehow developed these networks in an alternate way. What it does tell us is that for some reason, those networks are really darn important.
Right.
Even in the absence of the major thoroughfare for information transfer, the brain figures out a way to have those bilateral systems.
That's really interesting. Have there been any studies that suggest compensation pathways that you might be looking at in the future?
There's nothing very specific. We're interested in the cerebellum and some of the lower brain structures and how they may be mediating this process.
Okay. When you're doing this a study like this and looking for synchronization in these different networks, how do you do the study? Are you doing functional magnetic resonance imaging? What's the basic process that you do to observe how the brain is activated?
Yeah, we were doing fMRI, functional magnetic resonance imaging, and we were doing a resting state acquisition. So they're not doing any type of task. I believe we did ours with eyes open. There's some back and forth. You can do it with eyes closed, eyes open, but you want them to be awake. Mm-hmm. And presumably
sleeping is not the resting state you're looking for.
No, that's not the resting state we want. And they're supposed to not be thinking about anything in particular. So we always do an interview afterward to find out what they were thinking about and kind of see if there are any themes or those kind of things that might be an artifact along the way.
Right.
And then what we do is take the resting activation and use a principal components analysis to identify the areas of the brain that spatially and temporally have coordinated activity. So, you know, spatially, it's just which of these areas have this coordinated temporal activation and seem to be working in as a system.
Okay. Is there, as you're looking at this, I mean, you're imaging the entire brain. So do you see activity in the corpus callosum of normal patients? Is there any way that you could take the corpus callosum out?
When you're looking at an fMRI, you're looking at the activation or the processing of oxygen and through glucose, actually processing of glucose and oxygenation levels. And that goes on in gray matter, not in white matter. And the corpus callosum is white matter. So at this point, there's no way to look at the activity of the callosum.
Okay. Is there any methodology that that can get at the white matter, at the actual, electrical activity?
Not at this point. We have one of my colleagues here, Mike Tischke, who's lead on this paper, has been working on this some. There's several labs that are trying to figure out, is there a way to get at that? But it's challenging.
Yeah, to say the least, right? what kind of in terms of challenges? What kinds of challenges do you come up against when you're studying corpus callosum disorders?
Probably the biggest challenge is funding. Sorry, which I realize
that's not necessarily a scientific challenge, but it's fair to say.
Well. And I guess it's just that it represents the challenge of studying a topic that has for so long been viewed as a non-topic. And so because the lore was that you could be perfectly normal without this, there wasn't that much interest.
Right.
Now we know the incidence appears to be quite a bit higher. And then we knew previously, thinking that would raise some interest. And the typical response we get is, it's such a heterogeneous population because they tend to have other brain abnormalities. There is clearly this cohort, though, of this group, maybe even up to 50%, that don't have a lot of other brain abnormalities. So trying to figure out how do we convince other researchers that this is an interesting and relevant population, and without parents that are screaming and making a huge deal out of something, without a good campaign, you don't get the funding. One of the things that always amazes me is something like Tourette's that is so much
more
rare.
Because the people themselves are screaming,
right.
Yelling.
It's so much more rare, and it is far more well known. So, marketing does a lot.
It absolutely does. And with the subject you're studying, though, it seems like it would be such a basic question. You know, a lot of what we understand about how the brain works is based on disorders of the brain. A lot that we learn are from examples of people who are missing parts of their brain, who've had accidents. You know, these disorders tell us so much. So it seems as though, in addition to helping this population by characterizing the disorder, by learning about structurally what's going on. In doing that, it would also tell us so much about the wiring, the basic wiring for our brain.
It does. And that's, we're at the moment starting to do some work looking at development, because in a typically developing brain, we know that the corpus callosum, even though all the neurons are there, the axons are there in the callosum, the myelinization, the coating over them continues to develop into early adolescence. And as we understand it, a part of that myelinization may be contributing to some of the cognitive changes you see in adolescence. So you go through that junior mm-hmm. high phase when all of a sudden everything becomes more complicated. He thinks that I think that she thinks that you know, theory of mind becomes more complicated, reasoning becomes more complicated. And what we see in our kids with agenesis is their peers do this huge increase in social thinking and they don't keep up.
Right.
And so we'd really like to look at that, you know, longitudinally across that age span and see how is the corpus callosum contributing to that kind of social cognition, problem solving. We've had a fair amount of research on the frontal lobe now in adolescence, and I think this is a new topic that really needs to be addressed. But again, positioning it, the argument that this is kind of the disorder that can inform our understanding of the condition.
Of the condition and of teenagers.
And of teenagers, right. Yes. And of human development. And right.
Yeah, so. It seems like it's something that more people would be interested in if the message got out in the right way.
Right. And that's a challenge. The reason I helped start the National Organization for Disorders of the Corpus Callosum was because there was a group of families that had connected with each other, and there was so much that they were teaching each other. And they were so much more informed about these conditions than the medical field, frankly, that it was really powerful to have them come together. And as with Warren's initial bringing the families together and listening, it was a great scientific opportunity to observe and but also to help them support each other. So getting the families together has been great for them. The dilemma is, because they have so few resources, these families are all over the country just surviving. And right. We haven't had the kind of parent that had the resources to be the champion. And
you don't have a Jenny McCarthy yet.
No.
You don't have a celebrity out there.
Exactly. Now, the one celebrity we do have, we've never quite been able to figure out how to capitalize on, I don't think, which was Rain Man.
Right. Oh, was that a corpus callosum?
Mm-hmm.
Kim didn't realize that.
Yeah, Kim Peek, the person who was the real Rain Man, actually had agenesis of the corpus callosum.
Interesting. That's mm-hmm. That's not something I realized.
Yeah.
Should capitalize on that.
We thought about it, and Kim has come to several of our conferences. There was a great documentary called The Real Rain Man, where mm-hmm. we had a chance to explain more about the agenesis as well. So that has gotten the information out some.
Yeah. To go back to the study with the synchronization, I was just thinking about that. Has anyone looked at synchronization in adults who have had their corpus callosum destroyed or severed?
Yeah, there is one study. I can't remember the year. Author is Johnson. There was a case study of an individual, and they did, I think, resting bulge pre and post callosotomy. And you do lose the interhemispheric coordination.
Okay. So this is an example of how the development makes the difference. So if you develop without the corpus callosum, the synchronization stays intact. But if you have it severed as an adult after development, then the brain has problems. compensating right. because the pathways that it relies on have been taken away.
Right.
Oh, that's so interesting.
I mean, that does suggest that for the rest of us, we do rely on the callosum for yeah. these systems. And somehow the brain has compensated for that.
I think that's fascinating. It's just another example of the, as you said, plasticity of the brain and just the amazing nature of our brain to be able to allow people to function almost normally mm-hmm. in society.
Yeah. The tragedy, I think, and the thing that catches my heart with this group is those who are cognitively fairly intact, they, you know, some have graduate degrees, some have college degrees, and they can't really function that well in society. And so you have these individuals who don't meet our criteria socially for long-term care. They don't get SSDI because their IQ is too high.
Right.
But they can't hold a job because their social skills are so poor. They misread cues. They get fired. They mess things up. They're that awkward person that no one quite wants around, and they're socially isolated. And it's just heartbreaking. So hopefully by intervening younger, we'll help some of these kids avoid that. I think the saddest are the parents of the adults that didn't find out until they were adults. And mm-hmm. their heartbreak at thinking, if only I had known.
Right. I could have done things differently.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The other issue with the funding is, since it isn't something you can cure.
Right. There's no drug. There's no treatment. Yeah.
And genetics is the main interest in a lot of fields right now. So if in our work, we're not as concerned about the cause and more about the helping somebody cope, understanding how it impacts them, developing ideas for intervention, then that's a harder sell.
Yeah. Yeah, a much harder sell.
Yeah,
the pharmaceutical money or the research money, just it's not going to go that direction. Yeah, which is unfortunate. That's very unfortunate. But I'm really glad that you're doing the research that you're doing, and you've started the organization that you started, National Organization on Disorders of the Corpus Callosum. It's, you know, it's a step or many steps in the right direction, and working with multiple research institutions and researchers to develop research programs that are coordinated on this. It seems like the ball is rolling, and mm-hmm. that you are going to help make strides.
I hope so.
It's great. It's really great. Well, I thank you so much. We're at about 5 o'clock now, so we're getting at the end of the show. Is there anything that, you know, anything else about the disorder, the corpus callosum science that you do that you'd like to share with everyone out there?
I guess the main thing is just the fact that it is relevant. And often still I will hear parents say, I was reading through the MRI report trying to find anything that it said that might relate to what's going on. And they contact me because no one ever said the corpus callosum absence might be part of the problem. So just being aware of it and reaching out to the organization, participating, that makes a huge difference. It gives us the support to keep doing science.
Yeah, absolutely. And this show, we're all about supporting doing good science. So once again, thank you very much, Dr. Paul, for joining me on the show today. I really appreciate your time. It's been great.
Great. My pleasure.
Thanks. And anyone who's interested in learning more about the corpus callosum and Dr. Lynn Paul's research, you can visit emotion.caltech.edu/AGCC for more information. I'm Dr. Kiki, and this has been the Dr. Kiki Science Hour. Next week, We're not talking about anything. It's Thanksgiving. So enjoy your turkey, your cranberries, your mashed potatoes, whatever it is you plan on eating next Thursday. Say thanks for your brain and for science. And I'll be back with more science-y conversations on December 1st. Until then, you can pursue my science-y pursuits. I'm on Twitter, Facebook, and Google Plus, the social networks out there. Dr. Kiki, and Kiki Sanford is how you can find me, respectively. And you can email me comments, suggestions, questions at drkiki@drkiki.tv. You can also go to my website, drkiki.tv. It's pretty easy stuff. You can subscribe if you want more sciencey goodness to Dr. Kiki Science Hour in iTunes, or just visit twit.tv/Kiki. And in the next week, if you need more sciencey goodness, you can always listen to other episodes of This Week in Science, my other show, found at twist.org, or you can join me in my science chat every Friday, noon to 1 p.m. Pacific time on JustinTV/Dr. Kiki. I will see you in 2 weeks, not next week. Thanks for tuning in to my science hour. Remember, all I ask is an hour a week, and I do hope that that hour makes your world a whole lot more interesting. Now for your science meditation of the week.